From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in well-lit Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are 3D lighting and menus versus parkour. And so, if everybody is ready, let's start. So it is the day after No King's Day 3.
Is this the third one?
There was three, yes. This was the third.
I know there was one last year.
There were two last year, one in October and one in June.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why. Okay, got it.
Yeah. And it's part of a pantheon of events of its ilk, so it's not unusual to forget the number.
Yeah.
But it was supposedly the biggest, it was all over the country.
Right.
Yes, and also the world, actually. Yeah.
Here in Minnesota, anyway, it was billed as one of the flagship events. Mm-hmm. Took place at the Capitol in St. Paul, mm-hmm. and the Ice Out protest from January was set a record, and this beat that record.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think partly because it's broader. I think the space was probably easier for people to get to, and it was way warmer.
Yeah, true.
yeah.
Yeah.
And on a weekend, I believe, is part of it too.
Yeah.
As far as it being large, it is a little too early for final counts or final estimates, but the rough estimate that they are saying these days is that 200,000 people attended.
Mm-hmm.
There are some wonderful photos starting to come out on the media of how far the people stretch.
Mm.
Start in three places and then march towards the Capitol, like from here to the Capitol. And actually, I believe that there is a Christian activist group that is doing a Palm Sunday march today, also at the Capitol.
Dear listener, it is Sunday where we are recording.
Yes.
Yes, and No King's Day was Saturday, mm-hmm. yesterday. That's how calendar math works. We're good at it now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always difficult for us to be timely because things are important to us in the moment, but it'll be weeks before you hear this, and so there'll be all sorts of news between now and then. But it was a really big deal. We want to mark it.
Yeah.
Make sure we let, you know, we note it. We don't forget that the things out in the world are happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We talk about video games a lot, and it's easy. And people use it as an escape mechanism, and it's vital for that. But it's important to be aware of things that are going on as well.
Yeah. And also, like, I personally have had experience where I'm playing games that were very palpably relevant to things happening at the time,
mm-hmm.
And resonated for me in particular ways. And so I hope if that is happening to you, that you have those feelings and have those thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, and if you're having a nice game on the side while the world is going on, enjoy that as well. Take that rest.
Yeah,
for sure.
There's an avenue for participation that can sometimes feel very like a tough hill to climb to make a difference in the world. And big public mass protests are an easy entry for a lot of people, but it's also important that a lot of people participate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a way of using your voice. And when we think about ourselves as game developers, we think about our voices and what we want to say. And and if that is just giving people a good time, that is an effective and noble use of your voice.
Yeah.
But it's days like this when you think that like there's an opportunity to use your voice, whether you are feel that you're an artist or not. But then when you go back to your day job, if your day job is a game developer, it is sometimes you have to kind of think, actually, I have more opportunities to use my voice than people in other professions do.
Yeah.
And there's a responsibility to that like, you know, everyone has a different approach to it. But times like this remind you that like we all can have avenues to participate. And so find as many in your life as you can.
Yeah. Or facilitate and uplift the other people using their voices.
Yep.
If you cannot participate, give them a ride. Metro Transit employees did a great job of making sure that people got home safely and orderly. And even though it took a hot minute to get back because there were 200,000 people leaving the Capitol.
Right.
Yeah.
So thank you to them. You know, making sure that you're someone's emergency contact number, all of those things. So find a niche, find a way. And if that is not your voice, but making sure someone, like letting someone else feel more able to use theirs, do that.
Yeah. All good points. We kind of buried the lead a little in that, Mark, you haven't been in the clubhouse in quite some time.
Yeah, so we're back from GDC.
Yes. Yep.
And we recorded our part two GDC episode remotely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got snowed in.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And prior to that was the first part, which we recorded in San Francisco. Prior to that was three episodes I wasn't part of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And prior to that was our what we did. But basically, I have been waiting to talk about the Star Trek cruise that
yeah.
I went on. Which is why I missed those episodes. And during GDC, I mean, those episodes were epic and it just wasn't room for it. But right. I was like, just because I hadn't really, you know, had an opportunity to talk to listeners, but also as much to either of you mm-hmm. About the silly fun that Dale and I had
yeah.
on the Ocean Blue. I think I talked about this when like I signed up for this thing, but like I'm an unusual person to go on a cruise. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but like it was just, it was a contained vessel full of Star Trek. So like
you had to do it.
Now it made sense.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I took like, it was a week long mm-hmm. and I took a ton of notes on every day because so much stuff happened. Like I, you know, I ran into, you know, all the actors and production people that were guests on the thing.
Yeah.
I made some friends.
Yeah.
I also, was, relatively antisocial as far as being a person on a cruise goes. Hmm. I kind of kept to myself a lot.
Sure.
Which I thought might, because every time I heard about it, I was like, oh, it's the thing where it's a convention. Everyone has this thing in common. It's so easy to make friends. And I did make some friends, but I also probably didn't make as many friends as some of the people who are good at it
oh,
do.
Oh, sure.
Like it is, even being there, it's amazing how like high energy and how like welcoming and how communal the space is.
Yeah.
And for someone like me who has difficulty participating in that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
There was enough of it and I got to have a little.
Okay.
Aww. And it was quite nice.
That's good.
Yeah, but I will say I'm not that excited about ever taking a cruise again.
Sure.
That part was not much fun.
Yeah, I don't. If cruises always kind of confuse me.
It feels like yeah. you would be stuck on a shopping mall, like inside of a shopping mall for a long time.
That is yeah. pretty much like, what it is, yeah.
The only cruises that have appealed to me have been those like European river cruises where it is more boat than mall.
Mm.
Yeah.
And even then I'm skeptical.
Right, right. But it's interesting because like, especially because we just came back from GDC and one of the things about like a Star Trek convention
yeah.
and certainly was on overdrive here was that there are panels, sessions, mm-hmm. talks to go to hosted by all and sometimes like comedy events and entertainment pieces. But like I went to like a bunch of science seminars given by the science consultants. For
Star Trek.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was really cool. Dr. Erin McDonald, who is one of the science consultants, she and also sort of had a cameo on more than one of the more recent Star Trek shows. She talked about like what's new in astronomy, and so just recapping the latest stuff from the last year.
Yes.
She has a background in astrophysics, and it was just able to just it was like a just like auditing a class basically. Or if you're ever in Los Angeles, they do these like science talks at the Griffith Observatory
mm.
that are like really really famous, and that reminded me of that, which I had done that once, and where it's like it is kind of like a live YouTube video of
yeah.
some you know edutainment kind of thing. It was fun. It wasn't like a college class,
sure.
but it was at the same time very nerdy, informational, and not. No effort was made to make it entertaining. It just was because it was such an interesting topic.
Mm-hmm.
Bunch of those things that were sort of just interesting on their own. And then just, of course, a ton of Star Trek stuff. Actors talking about their experience. Armin Shimerman, who plays Quark. Steven, your favorite character.
Yeah.
He was there and did a Shakespeare seminar.
Oh.
That makes sense.
Talking about the language, the use of language
yeah.
specifically, like not necessarily the narrative, but really like the context of the words spoken in that era.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yes.
it was really, really interesting. And the way he talked about pathos and logos, like as different methods for actors approaching text.
Yeah.
And I found it so fascinating. And it was really fun because, you know, then there was the question and answer time. And of course, you know, he kind of teed it up being like, this is a Shakespeare seminar. Like I know you all want to ask about the Celestial Temple and, you know, and,
yeah.
and all the Star Trek stuff.
Yeah.
But like every time someone tipped toward that, like, you know, like what was your favorite episode or whatever? Like no one was that bad.
Okay.
But like he would like really rein it in.
Okay.
Like not and to the point where everyone got the hint.
Yeah,
that's... and ended up being it was really good. And okay. So there was a bunch of stuff like that, the kind of thing that like you couldn't really do at a regular convention,
right?
Because everyone on this thing is so saturated with Star Trek content that you can be a little bit freer. You can mm-hmm. do more types of things. This is, I think, why the people who are guests on the cruise like really really love it.
Yeah.
One, because you really can just walk around and see people. I think because everyone's in contained area, the cost of being a nuisance as like a passenger is so high that like nobody does it.
Sure.
So you will just be standing in line for pizza with like the star of Deep Space Nine. Like,
yeah.
And it's just like totally fine.
I love that.
No one's weird about it.
Okay. That's cool.
Or you'll run into someone in chat. It's like it is kind of wild.
I love that though, just especially the like other topics. One, because in Star Trek, Shakespeare comes up a lot.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I've mostly watched Next Gen, but like Data was learning Shakespeare, and mm-hmm. like there's a lot of Shakespeare trained actors who work in Star Trek.
Yep.
But also just I as a person love when you get to learn something new.
Yeah.
And very much what my mom would say, where it's like, be careful, you might learn something. That's also why I love anime that are like, oh, this is an anime about this sport, or like about making desserts.
Yeah.
You know, I love when it's just like, oh, I get to learn very much too deeply about a topic while enjoying myself in this other nerdy context.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And the main events on the boat, which were, so like the panels and stuff, I found that probably most fascinating. The most entertaining was every night there was a big production,
mm-hmm.
And quite varied. So one of them was Anthony Rapp, who played Paul Stamets on Discovery.
Yeah.
He's a Broadway guy. He was in the original cast of Rent.
Oh.
And every night was a different show that was a totally different production. And the one, he did one that was just, the title of it was like, Songs I Like to Sing.
Cool.
And it's like, all throughout the day, there's lots of stuff happening. You can choose to go to this or that, or, you know, things are happening all at once. You have to pick. At night, everyone sees the same show. They do two nights, and they split the group in half.
Yeah.
So you go to the early show or the late show.
Oh. Okay.
So, like, if I had the choice, I might have been like, I don't necessarily know that I want to go see someone who I know is, like, is into opera and like, a Broadway kid.
Yeah.
Like, do a sing a bunch of songs. Like, sure. I'm like, I'm sure it's really, but not really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, because it was the nightly show, like, you got all the nightly shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much wrong about this one. Basically, he sang, like, I think he's like 10 years older than me, but he basically sang all the music I love from my teenage years.
Oh, ah, nice! Okay.
So he did like a Radiohead cover. He did two David Bowie songs. Oh. He did a Talking Heads song.
So amazing.
He did a Rilo Kiley song, which for people who know that band, it's not like they're a deep cut or anything, but they're like a 2003 college radio band.
Yeah.
Wow.
That like I played in heavy rotation when I was a college radio DJ in 2003. and so it was quite surprising. Now, of course, he picked from each of those bands' catalog the most musical number song that they did.
Sure.
Like he did David Bowie's Heroes, which is very theatrical.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he brought that energy.
The most show kid of their discography.
Exactly right. But it was a big surprise. And so a lot of the things were like that. So Nana Visitor, who played Kira on Deep Space Nine,
mm-hmm.
she has, for the past couple of years, has done a stage reading of an original series episode that she directs.
Oh.
And so all the cast that comes on the boat, they all play original series characters. So this year, Jonathan Frakes, who played Riker on Next Generation, he played Captain Kirk.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
They staged The Man Trap, which was the first episode of Star Trek aired on television.
Ah.
It was like the fifth one produced. It was the first one aired. And because it's the 60th anniversary of Star Trek this year, that's why they tied that in.
Sure.
And it was really funny because it was a stage reading, but it had set pieces. Everyone was in fun costumes. It was very... everyone had scripts in their hands, so it wasn't like a fully practiced production.
Right.
But it also wasn't a table read.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was, and they had opportunity. They did the script straight, but they were being a little silly about it, and the staging was kind of fun. Eugene Cudero, who played Rutherford on Lower Decks, he played Bones.
Oh.
And really cool. Brought a ton of energy to like He's Dead Jim. Like it was quite incredible to see this mix of the different generations of actors. All paying homage to the original series.
That's awesome.
And there was a really fun moment where, so On this cruise, because it was 60th anniversary, they had a couple of guest stars from the original series who were like in one or two episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, very old people at this point. They were also guests, and they did a panel or two. So in the man trap, there's a salt monster, like a creature in, mm-hmm. in a costume.
Yeah.
Pretty silly looking. Mm-hmm. It was played by a stunt woman who played both the character that in the episode and the monster in the costume. Kind of an interesting thing for that time. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the guests on the boat, and you know, into her 80s. And at the very end of the stage reading, when the shape shifting monster has the final form with the monster,
yeah,
you know, someone comes out with the mask on, the rubber mask on,
yeah,
and then it was her.
Oh, okay.
So she got to reprise her role in this goofy restaging.
That's great.
That's really cool.
Just, you know, so if you're a fan of Star Trek, it's just so valuable. But then the whole week was just filled with people talking about how, you know, just the ideals and the morals and the heart of Star Trek. Yeah. So it was just, you know, it was hard not to be swept up in all that energy and feeling good about this thing, even though it was an exercise in sort of like, you know, corporate brand loyalty.
Yeah. Sure.
In the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are tons of really fascinating stuff like that. And there is one thing that I want to mention that is related to the next bit of meta that I want to talk about.
Okay.
The show, which is that I listened to those episodes I wasn't on.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah.
And I talked all about how excited I was to meet Denise and Mike Okuda, art directors and authors of the Star Trek Encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
And I hear you talk about, Mark wanted some cool thing. He was into some person. I don't know. You didn't know. And then you even called yourself out like, he's going to be mad at me.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
But you're not mad, right?
I'm not mad.
Uh-huh.
I'm just disappointed.
Oh, no. That's worse.
No, it was cool. I got to chat with Mike Okuda about the first edition of the Star Trek Encyclopedia, which he was an art director starting on the Star Trek movies and then on Next Generation all the way through to the mid-2000s.
Wait, point of order. How many editions are there?
Of the Star Trek Encyclopedia?
Yes.
Five?
Okay, thank you.
Whoa.
The first edition was in black and white,
mm-hmm.
and he did the layout, the digital layout himself, rather than having someone at the publisher do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to him at a breakfast,
mm-hmm.
and he was saying, like, it's so cool that in Star Trek, there's the fans of the actors and the directors and the stars, but it's neat that us art director people get to have, like, fans too.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, you know, I'm a fan of you not because I perused the credits, but because your name is on the cover of the Star Trek Encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're underselling your public contribution.
Yeah.
And then he talked about, like, oh, that was, you know, that first edition, that black and white one. I'm like, that's the one I had, the dog-eared copy.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about how, you know, I got to talk to him about desktop publishing software.
Oh, nice.
And I can't imagine many other people would have that conversation with him, because I did a little bit of that in college.
Yeah.
When I worked at a local arts newspaper. And, you know, he was a little bit of like the, you know, like, oh, I learned this software, but a friend of mine in publishing used a different one,
mm-hmm.
and would always razz me about it. And that was like a fun, you could tell he'd not gotten that question before.
Yeah. Yeah. Aww. That's great.
That's always fun as a fan to sort of like provide something new to mm-hmm. the people you're fans of. But yes, the whole experience was pretty wild. I feel like I've barely said anything about it. There's so much stuff that happened. There was a whole improv show from Tawny Newsom and Eugene Cordero that Dale provided a story for.
Oh,
and
yes.
So they riffed on my vacation to London for half an hour.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Maybe Dale can tell that story next time she's on the program.
Sure.
But yeah, pretty wild stuff. Mm-hmm. But I will say, there, I also heard the other episodes I wasn't on.
Right.
And I have some notes here.
Okay.
So other than generally disappointed.
Oh, sure.
You even listened to the tabletop one. Wow. Oh.
All right. Steven, there was no Kirby merch at Super Nintendo World.
What? I am upset. So upset.
Because there's no Kirby at all at Super Nintendo World.
Oh, my.
It's only the merch of the characters that are there.
Well, I'm never going.
So lots of DK stuff.
Okay.
Mario, of course.
Okay.
Some Pikmin stuff, because there are Pikmin.
Pikmin stuff?
There's actual Pikmin hidden throughout Super Nintendo World.
I'm so mad right
I'm
now.
I'm now really glad that we got something at the Nintendo store in San Francisco. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Really bad. If
yeah, I've had tons of Nintendo experiences. So for listeners, Super Nintendo World is a theme park, Universal theme park.
Yeah.
Dale and I went on this cruise, but then we ended up spending some days in Orlando.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Super Nintendo World. I did tell you that I was going to get you Kirby merch. There just wasn't any.
You can't call it Super Nintendo World and not have Kirby. Graceful.
Not very smart. Write a letter. Of them.
Okay, also.
Uh-oh, wait, hold on. Dale's coming in.
Hi. Can we put my PowerPoint presentation on the Patreon?
maybe. Yeah, Dale recapped her whole vacation in a PowerPoint.
It was very good.
With many people. Yeah, maybe we'll put that on Patreon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
okay. So you were talking in the Tabletop episode about GURPS.
Yes.
There is a Star Trek source book for GURPS. I think there was some theorizing about that.
Okay.
It's based on what's called the Starfleet universe.
Mm. Oh, sure. Okay.
There was a company licensed Star Trek in the mid-70s. This was before any of the movies or any of the other shows. And then made a role-playing game, a tabletop war game.
Yeah.
And then called Starfleet universe. Starfleet as two words. And then they developed their own lore. It's split because the license only applied to the original series.
Oh.
But because it was a tabletop war game, it was relatively popular. It had its fans. To this day, you can go to a hobby shop and buy a source book that is licensed Star Trek, because that license didn't expire, but it is not the Star Trek universe you know. It's a specific one that split off in the mid-70s.
Really?
Fascinating.
And there was a GURPS version, a role-playing game based on that universe.
Okay.
I thought you'd all like to know.
That's cool.
Yes, thank you.
Also, I have here in my notes somewhere it was a runabout. I don't know. There was some discussion about not knowing what a thing was, and I don't know what that was about.
You were basically, you're probably right.
Yeah, you were like talking about a shuttle, and you didn't know what it was called. I don't know. All right. Last note here.
Okay.
What's this about Sledgehammer Bride?
Oh. I never told you. Shoot.
You even said on the episode, if this is the first time Mark's hearing about it. Steven, this was weeks ago that I listened to that episode. We've been to GDC and back. I've been waiting.
Oh, my gosh.
And in all that time, you never volunteered this information. What is this about Sledgehammer Bride?
I'm sorry. Okay. So, you know, I've been part of this new co-op, Melanated Game Kitchen, for a while.
Yes.
A few months ago, I pitched Sledgehammer Bride as a game that we could potentially work on.
Right.
There were three games.
And they were like, here's $500,000.
If we had the money, yeah. There were three games that were pitched during that thing. One of them was kind of pitched, and it was they only really wanted some support to work on it and didn't really want it to be a Melanated Game Kitchen thing. So that was weird.
And it was Sledgehammer Bride, so who cares?
Right. There was the second one.
Also, I don't care.
And then Sledgehammer Bride.
Hey!
Sledgehammer Bride is the most popular game that was pitched during that pitch meeting, and people really want to work on it.
I'm not even a little bit surprised.
Yeah, it's
not even a little
bit. That's awesome.
I'm not either. I'm not going to lie. So we have been actually actively discussing working on this game. And literally yesterday.
That's the makings of a plan.
Literally yesterday.
That's fixing to get ready.
Yeah. Literally yesterday, we established, we had another planning meeting about Sledgehammer Bride. And we're not working on this other game because the person who is running it doesn't have the capacity to do creatively. So it's just Sledgehammer Bride right now.
Yep.
In addition to the two other games that Melanated Game Kitchen already.
Who cares about those?
I'm kind of curious. We should hear about them, if only so that way we can know that Sledgehammer Bride is better.
Exactly. But basically, we're establishing teams. We're figuring out like scope. We're going to be having more future conversations about Sledgehammer Bride. We literally have a Discord channel on it now. So it's happening again.
Discord official. Important question. Now that you know me for over a year, would I like Sledgehammer Bride?
Honestly, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know how many beat-em-ups you play. It's a beat-em-up game.
Huh.
I'll describe it after the show.
Okay.
More. Cool. Yay. And then you could tell me, because I'm curious. If you don't like it, that's fine, too.
And then if I haven't played a beat-em-up knowingly, then maybe it'll be my first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in 2 years or whatever. The thing about Melanie Game Kitchen is that this is like everybody's third thing.
Yeah.
So
right, to temper the excitement about the makings of a plan, the fixing to get starting. This isn't like there's no budget. It's still you're just sort of putting together Now, is this something that you might want to put together as a pitch or get some concept art made so that you can take it out and get some cash?
These are the kinds of conversations that we'll be having in the future.
Okay.
Yeah, because we haven't figured that out. We do want to do some work to like start developing like an actual prototype and talk to everybody. Like what kind of people we have available to work on things. Mm-hmm. We're kind of art light, which is...
That's new for you.
Yeah.
Well, it's great for me, but I don't know that it's great for the project because there's a particular vision and the art style is a significant part of that vision.
Right.
And I think
we talked a lot about how you had some general ideas, but you wanted to partner with someone to develop that art style.
I can't create that vision because I'm not an artist in that way. So I need somebody to help me with that. And so it's a little unfortunate that we don't have somebody who... can potentially be like an art director in that way, but we can work towards it as a group and maybe you can get some help from people to get it to happen.
Yeah.
These are all kinds of conversations that we have to have in the near future. But basically, you know, we're working on it, I guess. Yeah. So that's exciting news.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
I'm crushed. You didn't tell me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's so many opportunities.
But yesterday was the last thing. He said that something happened yesterday, so you wouldn't have gotten that juicy detail.
Right.
I suppose.
Yeah, so that's why I held it, and definitely not for other reasons. Anyways.
I'm so excited. I'm gonna believe that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thrilled. I can't wait to hear more.
Yeah.
That's exciting, and I can't wait for listeners to hear more as well.
Yeah.
All right. Should we, at this late runtime, actually get into it?
Oh, geez. How long have we gone?
Don't worry about
it. Okay. Yeah, let's go. Mark, you've got a topic?
I've got a topic. Man, I'm really rusty, but...
That's fair.
I want to talk about 3D lighting.
Okay.
Because a game that I am working on, which is called Lyndale Center.
Ooh.
I don't know that I've said the name of it before, but it was what I was pitching at GDC.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm working on it with a friend of the show, Sam, who was on one of our GDC episodes, and my colleague, Mike, who I worked with on Dream Settler before that was canceled. We are developing this game. We are full on it.
Nice.
We're doing some vertical slice demo prototypey stuff right now. Coming back from GDC, I don't know how much I talked about this in part two of the episode because it's all a blur now.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot of stuff.
Pitching went very, very good.
Yes.
We're in a bunch of people's inboxes and we got follow-ups right away. People seem very earnestly excited to see more.
That's great.
We now have to deliver a little bit more.
Sure.
So who's to say what happens next?
Yeah.
But we are looking towards, proper pre-production and fingers crossed this time in, I don't know how long this takes, a couple of months, we'll actually have a budget to on production and actually get this thing made.
Exciting.
And published. So that's exciting. But what that means is that I have got to take some of our concept imagery and initial 3D scenes that we put together for the pitch. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of assets for the pitch. I think that was one of the reasons why it went well.
Yeah.
We didn't do concept art. We actually did some production art.
Yeah.
And really laid forward a pretty strong vision that we could sort of describe and illustrate.
Mm-hmm.
But now we need to make that playable because there was some smoke and mirrors involved.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I did for the project was because it was built on the bones of the Dream Settler project, there's parts of the structure that that Mike and I are carrying over.
Yeah.
I need to sort of modernize the project a little bit.
Okay.
And that includes, one, Dream Center was a fully 2D game. It had some 3D elements in it, which is, I don't know if anyone knew that. You know, if you were following that game, that's a spoiler, I guess, for the game is not coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But those 3D elements were based on the built-in render pipeline in Unity, which is an older system.
Right.
Because we had a lot of like really weird shader stuff
that
we didn't really want to update and we didn't have a performance concern.
Sure.
This project doesn't have retro styling. It's meant to be a relatively realistic 3D first-person puzzle game.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to convert the project to the newer render pipeline in Unity, which I say newer, but it's been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
But their transition for Unity and for a lot of game makers has been very slow.
Yeah.
It's called Universal Render Pipeline. It is a much better system. I used it on Blippo. Mm-hmm. It is it's faster. It has more capabilities. And I used it on Blippo for a purely 2D.
Okay.
But it was much easier to work with shaders. And RenderGraph was better and faster. I'm excited to use it on this. But it required a little bit of tearing down and rebuilding back up.
Sure, for sure.
And as part of that process, I'm finally getting to my topic,
yeah,
which is 3D lighting.
Okay.
Because I am now taking the scene that we built and we're blocking out lots of it and actually building up a lot of it. And I'm actually going to be doing the lighting on it. Okay. Sam is our environment artist. Sam is taking a, for our overworld, Sam is taking maps that I have made, mm-hmm. Which are very specific, but don't have all the details in it.
Yeah.
And she is building out the 3D spaces in a way that is like architecturally rigorous.
Mm.
And like, man, she's doing such a great job.
Awesome.
We are working so well together on this. But that is then coming back to me in the project. And then I am doing lighting, compositing, color stuff.
Yeah.
Partly because I have the vision for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know what that needs to look like in this project because it's sort of like it sort of came from me.
Yeah.
Even though I would say Sam is doing so much of the actual work, including a lot of like the filling in the vacuum creatively.
Yeah.
Like I want to make sure she gets her flowers for that because like I had this vision of what I wanted it to look like, but Sam colored it in for me.
Yeah.
In a way that isn't, but it still had to come back to me for the sort of final paint.
Sure.
And that's what I'm doing now. So I used to do this a lot when I was in video production.
Yeah.
I was a motion graphics compositor. I did a lot of 3D stuff in After Effects specifically,
okay.
A little bit of Cinema 4D. I'm not a modeler, but I am an animator.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I was principally paid quite well in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
Missed those days as a compositor.
Yeah.
So framing, lighting, shading, color processing. I'm a professional in that area.
Yeah. Okay.
And I've had almost no opportunity to use those skills as a game developer.
Sure.
And so Blippo gave me some opportunity to use it in sort of a creative, stylistic way.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a whole brand new thing. I'm so excited to be able to be doing this. Like
yeah.
Placing lights, like things like, you know, a shadow fall off. I miss it. but I've never known how to do any of that in video games because I've only really made 2D games or 3D pieces in 2D games.
Yeah.
It's not expertise I have.
Yeah.
But I know the concepts very well.
Okay.
So I've been on this last 2 weeks since getting back from GDC. I have been on a crash course on really actually tackling 3D lighting in video games.
That's really cool.
And yeah.
I think it's great that you have that opportunity to transfer some of those skills you haven't been able to stretch in a while.
It's very satisfying
yeah.
when something looks right. Now, getting it there, oh boy.
Right. I guess,
quick question. Are you going for the same architectural, like rigorous architectural fidelity that Sam is going with making the assets,
yes.
or are you go okay?
Yeah, I guess the follow up was or more stylized, more cinematic, perhaps.
Maybe not even that, but like better lit in the sense of like you know, a space may make sense for the lighting, but in terms of moving around and seeing every corner and nook and cranny, it could use some more lighting.
Now, that's a really fascinating question because that speaks to sort of my instincts as a filmmaker going
with right,
that, which yeah. is that you want things to look real, but you're actually not doing that at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
You want things to feel real. Mm-hmm. Now, game developers know this instinct as well,
yeah.
where you want the verisimilitude, you want the understanding when someone looks or experiences something that you've made for them to say, this reminds me of, or this is very realistic, or this is very immersive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the literal things you are doing are quite different from
right.
a realistic depiction.
Right.
And that's the difference between immersion and simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big theme for this game, actually, is that it's a very immersive experience. It's based on a sense memory
yeah.
that I want people to feel of a real thing. So
yeah.
so the realism in that sense is quite important to this project.
Mm-hmm.
But like realistic simulated visuals, not as important to this project.
Sure.
So where that line is really a matter of craft.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There is no, and this is why I'm not really going to get into a lot of the actual details. You can find tons of tutorials. I will share a bunch of links for things that I have been doing just to get the nitty gritty of,
yeah.
of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the key message of it, and I will repeat this at the end, is that it is all smoke and mirrors. It is it's the artist's eye that determines all these things.
Yeah.
And that includes whether it looks real or not.
Right.
There is no objective standard you can say this looks real because I took these steps, I lit it in this way, I structured it in this way, that is realistic.
Mm-hmm.
You actually need, and maybe this is speaking, I can speak confidently because this is a thing I have done professionally.
Right.
And maybe that's not the approach people will take because I think it is important to learn what feels versus looks real.
Yeah.
And that's not something that comes easy. I think I have a head start there. But it's important not to get in the trap of like trying to just get a scene working so that it is accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one, we do not have the tools for that.
No. Yeah.
As you get deeper into this topic, you realize, because I started being like, okay, I'm going to get these things where I'm making choices about what this thing is, and I will light it based on what it is, mm-hmm. and then I'll see how it looks.
Yeah.
And then I'll make tweaks so that it looks more, you know, accurate from that sense memory
sure.
perspective.
Right.
But I found out very, very quickly that you reach that point almost immediately.
Oh.
You start thinking of it as a simulation and then you want to craft it later. But the crafting part happens all right away.
Okay.
Yeah.
In a way that can be very frustrating
yeah.
because there's so many decisions based on other decisions.
Yeah.
So, all right, I will get into some of the specifics and try to sort of barrel through a lot of these.
Sure.
So the basic thing you need to know about lighting in 3D games is that there are different methods, and it's different from the way I used to do things in a film or video where it's rendered once mm-hmm. and an animation because it needs to be interactive. There's interactive lights and baked lights.
Mm-hmm.
So real time or dynamic or interactive lighting is kind of what you think it is, right? You can animate a light, cast a shadow as it moves around. You can have it dynamically. You can put a flashlight on a character's gun, that yeah. sort of thing. It's what you think if you haven't done any of this before, you think all lighting is that.
Right.
And that is not, I mean, that's naivete, not ignorance, right? Because mm. it seems like games do work that way because the smoke and mirrors to get us to think they work that way is pretty complicated.
Yeah.
But in fact, quite a lot of lighting is baked, which is something that was like a genius idea that I think id Software came up with for Quake, which is like, it's too expensive on the GPU or the CPU in those days to actually cast lights and get these real-time shadows. Let's just do it once while we're editing, and then we'll just like copy what the shadows are doing on the wall and just write them to a bitmap and then overlay them on top of the thing, and then we don't have to do any lighting at all.
Yeah.
Because all lighting is just colors in the end. And so if you don't expect a light source to move or an object to move,
mm-hmm.
you can use baked lighting, which is, I would say, especially if you are going for something that feels real or you are doing a simulation, most of your lighting is going to be that.
Yeah.
That is where people get really tripped up because the workflow on that is slow and difficult. And for someone with my background, totally brand new to me. The iteration times between moving a light and then seeing how it looks,
sure.
how it interacts with everything
yeah.
is very slow.
Yeah.
And because you actually have to, that's why it's called baking. You press a button and you wait a while for
right,
it to
right.
bake.
Yeah.
It does, folks who've done it know exactly what this is. Folks who haven't, the first time they try it, they're like, oh, like it takes like 10 or 15 seconds. Like,
no.
I mean, maybe early when you're not a lot of stuff in your scene.
That's interesting because like, when I've done video editing, I did video editing and some Final Cut when I was in school.
Yeah.
Like the rendering time to, you'd make a bunch of edits and then you have to render it so you can watch back the edits. When I, years later, was doing a little bit of baked lighting as part of Code Coven homework, I was like, oh, it just reminds me of that. I get to swivel around in my non-existent swivel chair for a few minutes while this is, you know, getting its butt together.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, and that is really difficult when you're trying to like make choices, and so you have to kind of layer your choices, like
yeah.
bigger to smaller, right?
Yeah.
Right, right? Which is not uncommon for other types of systems and games, but I think when you're working creatively, it can be very, and that kind of discipline is helpful in Photoshop too, I suppose.
Sure.
But the cost of flitting around is high. So
yeah.
the first thing you generally will do in a scene is, especially if there's any outdoor component, if it is outdoors or there's like in our game, there's skylights,
mm-hmm.
You will have a sun. Generally, you have one directional light.
Mm-hmm.
And all that means is that light is cast in one direction from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a sun, but it's, you know, the sun is so far away as to functionally be a directional light.
Yeah.
If you're working in a stylized system or it's in space or something, you're not going to be dealing with this.
Yeah.
But that is often the first thing you do. And it's important to get that where you want it, not just because it impacts everything else in like aesthetically, but because of indirect lighting.
Yeah, okay.
So especially if you bake a light, real time does this as well. It's very expensive. You have global illumination, which is what happens when lights bounce off walls.
Yeah.
And when you have a powerful directional light meant to represent the sun, and all of your materials and all your objects reflect light, mm-hmm. then you could do all this tweaking and get everything just right in lights, but then you change something about the sun, and then it just completely, it's like pulling a big lever.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to lock in those choices, or at least your range of choices, so you can, you know, keep the door open a little bit if you want to tweak, but and then basically you cascade down. So
yeah.
the larger lights to the smaller lights, because mm-hmm. choices you make will not impact less as you make those changes.
Sure.
Quick question. So when you add the sun, is that the same thing as adding a skybox? Or is that part of what adding a skybox is, like, part of the package?
It very much depends. Mm-hmm. So in the system I'm working in, I have a skybox, but I'm not using it for any lighting.
Okay.
Mostly because we're in a building and there's windows, and so we're not using it as a light source.
Mm-hmm.
You can use a skybox as a light source. Mm-hmm. That's something you can do in video compositing as well, like just normal 3D work. And it can be very realistic, especially if you're doing animations. In game engines, that's also something that you can get base reflection. So for example, if you change the skybox to be like at dusk, mm-hmm. then that can be essentially the same as sort of casting a different color over the whole scene.
Yeah.
Now that's not that different from taking your directional light and applying a color to it, mm-hmm. but a skybox can provide more information.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very dependent on your project. So I'm not doing that in Lindale Center, but it is something you can do.
Okay.
And it is more finicky.
Yeah.
But you want to you just want to scale down to smaller decisions. Mm-hmm. And you really want to think about direct and indirect lighting.
Yeah.
So your direct lighting is just what the light is casting, and then the indirect is what it's bouncing off of.
Yep.
And there are lots of numbers to change. So
right.
when you think of most 3D rendering systems, they tend to be what's called, and materials and lights, mm-hmm. they tend to be what's called PBR, physically based rendering. And that's just kind of a buzzword to just let you know the calculations we do for this are based on how light really works.
Yeah.
That's what they're intending to say. It's not so much an actual standard as it is a philosophy.
Sure.
Now, it may mean something in specific contexts, but generally, I'm just saying most things bill themselves as being realistically derived.
Yeah, okay.
The problem is that's basically a lie. Not just because the simulation that you can run in a game engine is much more rudimentary than like a proper simulation or even a good 3D package. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you have so much power to tweak. So on a material or on a light, you can say this light casts an intensity of X, right? 1, 10, 5, 100.
Yeah.
That's how much light it's casting. You can also say that this light contributes this amount of indirect multiplication, which is something that is impossible to do in the real world.
Right, yeah.
Lights don't work that way.
Right.
But because this is an artistic endeavor, you know, you can make a simulation, but most of the levers that you pull are basically just you have to feel it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means, well, okay, I've got a directional light casting into this space, but there's no other light sources. So it's meant to be a dusky, dark room with the sun shining through.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to see it in there. I don't want to be blinded. I don't want the corners to be totally dark, but I want it to feel like they're pretty dark.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have a lot of indirect light that's a bounce off of this, but not too much because then it will just look like there's a light in the room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of tweak those values and then you say, well, now I'm going to put a lamp in the corner. Well, now that, if it's physically based and realistic, it would probably light up the whole room,
yeah.
depending on, you know, your context. So you would say, well, if I turn the intensity down, then it's just going to look dim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually want it to have a pretty high intensity, but I want it to contribute very little to global illumination.
Right.
Mm. Even though that is totally not realistic.
Yeah.
And is not how these things work.
Yeah.
And part of that is like, determined by the order in which you decide things. So you worked out your directional light or your sun first. And then you add things to it. Ultimately, a lot of surfaces get lit by many different lights. In the real world, you look at a 1 centimeter square part of the wall.
Yeah.
And even in a room with few lights, there are hundreds of reflective sources that all derive to do that.
Yep.
Games can get you, it works the same way, just on a lower scale. But when you're deciding you want it to be this bright or this dark, you actually do have to cheat all the time.
Huh.
It's actually quite wild how much you need to cheat.
Huh.
And that can be done with light settings. It can be done with material settings. Materials
yeah.
can have properties and different mappings to let you know that it contributes. The renderer on the mesh that brings in the texture or the material can also determine if it's contributing to global illumination or not.
Yeah,
which, you know, or is it just going to be lit by real time lights? And a lot of that has to do with whether it's moving or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's moving and you've baked all these lights, then the shadow is going to move with those things.
Right.
So you can't really bake those.
Yeah.
So you have to use other techniques. So there's a thing called mixed lighting, which bakes light maps, which are the textures that get painted onto things. But then it allows you to move things under them and it'll slide the shadows.
Ah, nice.
Not realistic.
Yeah.
And you can see some examples in some tutorials that demonstrate this, how like it feels for a second like it makes sense and then suddenly it all falls apart.
Mm.
And so that kind of technique is, you have to be very deliberate about it.
Sure.
You have to light your scene in a certain way so that when you use the mixed lighting, so that you can actually have dynamic objects that have some pre-rendered lighting on them, you move them in a way that doesn't break the illusion.
Yeah.
That's also true for reflections. So if you have mirrors or glass, you've all played games where like the mirror's a little bit too foggy.
Yeah.
Because the video game is like, you know it's a mirror. I'm not going to prove it to you.
Yeah.
Right? Because the proving it to you is very expensive.
Yeah, right.
I can make a copy of Mario and put him in a copy of the room.
Mm.
I can do that.
Yeah.
But that's about all I can do to make it realistic.
Right.
So you can do screen space reflections where you can kind of cheat it a little bit. Now, ray tracing, everybody knows about, is where you can get proper reflections. For most indie games, way too expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very hard to do. So I'm not covering that at all. I'm not going to be doing that.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But In games where you do want reflections and you do want to see some things reflected back in metallic or purely reflective surfaces, mm-hmm. you do things that are called reflection probes.
Yeah.
They are basically a little camera, like 360 cameras that you place in your scene at specific spots that will then take a picture of the scene, like a 360 picture,
mm-hmm.
and then that is what will be reflected back, no matter where you are.
Yeah. Okay.
So that can, the illusion on that can break kind of, but if you're looking at a second story window from the street,
yeah.
you can set your reflection probe at the spot between where the character's head would be and where the window is
yeah.
in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
And then that will take a photo, and then the reflection based on what you're how you're looking at that sphere
yeah.
will be cast onto reflective surfaces within an area of the game.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, I mean, I have very little experience with making anything. I took one class, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I'm an expert. But it's really interesting how the techniques sound the same to me, how you're describing yeah. like getting the lighting to work, but the actual things you're doing are vastly different.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, because you need to, when you're making a movie, right, a lot of the light sources that you're using are not natural light sources.
Right.
You, like, stage them outside of the camera so people can't see it, but it's supposed to still provide that feel that you want.
Mm-hmm. And also, you have those, essentially those big thing, I don't know what they're called, but the big things where it is just, you want them to have, use their own albedo effect to reflect lighting so
yeah.
it's gentler, right?
Right.
Like, as opposed to a light source, there's the light reflection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are those things called?
Like a bounce?
I guess. I don't know. It's big and white and you hold it up. You have someone holding it up to help the light go hit someone on the other side from the directional thing.
Yeah, I'm like drawing a blank. I think they're just called bounces.
Okay, cool.
It's all very, sometimes people use like foam board.
Yeah.
Those are very reflective.
Yeah.
Other times you get the fancy ones that fold out and are metallic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Or you'll use gels, like colored plastics
right.
in front of certain lights.
Yeah.
yeah.
Sometimes just very so subtly, just to change the color temperature of certain casts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now with LED lighting, you have lots more control. Basically, almost the amount of control you have in a video game.
Yeah.
To do these sorts of things, but in the end, it's all very smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. like back to the reflection probe example,
yeah.
Reflections are so expensive to do realistically, and they just weren't possible for a long time.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
But they also are not that critical to be totally accurate.
Yeah.
And so you can just take one photograph, you know, one 360 photograph in the middle of a scene,
mm-hmm.
and then if you're on the other side of the room and you look in the direction, and then it just paints that image.
Yeah.
And then as you walk, it shifts in a way that's realistic to a reflection.
Yeah.
But if you would actually cast a ray from your eye, it would not hit the thing that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But you don't care.
Yeah.
All of this is that.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that can be very frustrating because as someone who is doing a crash course on this and is very used to compositing and composing scenes for video, and that's where my my expertise in this concepts come from, learning the actual tools to do them has been a slow unwinding of like what I need to be precious about in a way in order to get the results that I want. Mm-hmm. And that has been challenging for me because I have done like some 3D stuff in games, but I feel like I know a lot conceptually, but I knew until a couple weeks ago, very, very little. Yeah. I would like hear these topics or I would watch a video or something, but I didn't have enough experience to really understand why these things were important and how they interrelated. And so it's been an interesting journey for me to sort of to get these. And I feel very empowered now.
That's good.
Because I've learned a little, and I'm, you know, I'm very much not an expert. There's a lot, you know, I've like been looking at the instruction manual for every setting and testing things out and getting an understanding of how they relate to each other and which order you should test them in and how they all work together.
Yeah.
And I'm getting a good handle on it, I think.
Okay, that's good.
But the most value is that it's unlocking skills I already had.
Right.
Which is, I think, in games, is probably true for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They have experience in things like, you know, narrative structure or visual composition or color theory.
Yeah.
Things they had brought from other things they did, either as a hobby or as a career.
Yeah.
And then in games, the tools to do those things are sometimes very similar. And then that fools you into thinking that they're all pretty similar.
Yeah.
And then you encounter one that's different, and then you forget you know a lot about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but when you learn that way of how to path your way from your knowledge to those techniques, suddenly, like I feel now like I've been doing this for years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually quite, and maybe that's just overconfidence at like first successes. But it's been pretty exciting.
Well, I mean, you have a lot of experience with that. And my understanding on how to like do these kinds of lighting things is it's highly technical. And like you have to have an understanding on how light works mm-hmm. and what reflects off of what and all these different materials and things. And you effectively have that same understanding in video games. You can just do whatever.
Yeah.
Effectively, because you're making all of those sources.
Yeah.
And so like it becomes a lot more. Because the tool set is different. It's kind of like learning a different programming language, feels like to me.
Yeah.
The way that you're describing it. In that, like, once you start learning, understanding the syntax and how that language works, you can do whatever you could do in C#.
Right. You realize you already knew how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it just takes some time to get to that point.
Well, you also speak to the sort of lack of limitations once you have those things unlocked and how that can be a little bit paralyzing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's just true in all areas is to like start building your own cage for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I want it to do. So I'm not going to try every technique there is and see what I like the best.
Yeah.
I'm going to aim for something. Even though I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And then I'll learn how to do it. And even though I'm learning other things to do, I'm not going to get distracted.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to get a little distracted.
Well, sure. But you have set those limits already. You said that this game is supposed to feel realistic. It's supposed to feel like a certain thing, right?
Yeah.
So you already know you don't want to have lighting. You don't want a sun to be in the center of wherever you are supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, right? I mean, that's a great example of like trying to get things that feels accurate, of like getting the right amount of like post-processing bloom to make it feel like there really is a midday sun coming through a skylight, but also not distracting to the point where it's casting so much light that the texture on the ground is completely blown out and white.
Yeah.
Because that might look good in a photograph, but as you're walking around it, it's going to feel fake.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how that interacts with different textures. And like it is a lot of fiddly bits in a way that is fun, but also you kind of have to constrain yourself with what you are aiming for a little bit in order to make any progress at all.
Right.
Because there's always, you could always try for another hour to make it a little better.
Yeah.
It's very, very tricky.
Have you hit any point where you fiddled with something long, because now you have these tools, you fiddled with something long enough and you've actually had to send an asset back for retexturing because it's just no matter what you do, the two things are not quite working together in a way?
Yes. So Sam, who is an experienced Maya modeler and has experience doing some lighting in game engines and knows these workflows better than I do, but doesn't have as much experience compositing in engines or in other contexts.
Yep.
We've been helping each other fill in the details.
Okay.
And so I'm looking at this and thinking like, well, okay, this seems kind of wrong. Is it because there's something wrong with this asset, or is it because there was a choice made for this asset that I didn't anticipate And so that I need to change something about how what I'm doing. And so being able to go back to Sam and saying like, what's up with this? And then she teaches me a little bit of like how she did the UV unwrapping.
Yeah.
And how like, and like, oh, there's 10 ways to do it. Here's the way I did it. And I'm like, I thought there were only 2 ways to do it. And so that's been really fun to have her to go back to and to have her work to build on. That's been a fun part of this collaborative process is that I get to use all the things I was good at from in the old days, which is compositing, lighting, 3D spatial composition.
Yeah.
Like stuff that I was really good at as a filmmaker and really loved as an animator, mm-hmm. but I'm not a modeler.
Yeah.
And so actually getting to the point where I can do composing and compositing requires stuff in the frame.
Right.
And like that's one of the reasons why I hadn't aimed at this hard because my standards for that sort of thing are a little bit higher.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Like I was never interested in doing like low poly 3D games.
Yeah.
Wasn't an art style I was interested in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that disadvantaged me, right? That wasn't a good thing, attitude of mine.
Sure.
That kept me from experimenting and learning some of these techniques because I had experiences elsewhere that biased what I was expecting from this kind of experience.
Yeah. Okay.
So having someone who is properly good at that and who I was working with directly on this aesthetic mm-hmm. Really removed that burden from me and I just got to do the work.
Cool.
And I've been loving that and it's been going really, really good.
That's awesome.
Huge thanks to Sam for being part of that team and being a great partner in this process as I'm learning a lot about this.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, should you all be so lucky to mm-hmm. have collaborators like that?
Yeah.
Really.
Okay, so Lydia just stepped out of the clubhouse
uh-huh.
for some reason.
Uh-huh, we don't know why.
And so it is now our responsibility to mercilessly tease her.
Yes. Well, actually, I mean, we're also supposed to tell people to do something for us on the show, right?
All
right,
we can do that instead.
Okay. We haven't done this in a while, but we wanted to ask folks to leave a review on your favorite podcast app about the show.
Yeah.
We'd like to think that if you're listening to us, you like us a lot. And so you want to give us a good review. But, you know, be honest. Let us know what you think and let other listeners know what you think as well. Because that lets them know that this program is worth their time.
Yeah, I think we've been on the air for nearly a decade.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think one of the things about reviews is it really helps new shows, mm-hmm. but it also helps small shows. And we're still a relatively small show
like,
in the scheme of things. I think we're probably maybe underselling ourselves there, but... for a long time, we were like, we're past the point of begging for this. But I think, no, we're not too good to beg for your thoughts, your reviews. Give us those 5 stars if you think we deserve it. Or if you want to, you know, just help us out and you think like maybe this is a 4-star podcast. But like, you know, they're nice fellas. And Lydia's all right, too. I'll give them that extra star just to buck them up.
Mm-hmm.
We can use everyone you can spare, which is all of them, I think.
Yes.
So Apple Podcasts is generally the way to go. There's not many other places, but there have been more in recent years.
Yeah.
So we can review us on Spotify. We actually get more reviews on Spotify and Pocket Casts than we do on Apple Podcasts. Mm. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that you don't generally leave written reviews on those other ones.
Oh.
But on Apple Podcasts, that's a big help is when you leave a written review. So
we're
happy any stars you can give us in multiple places if you can spare the time.
Right, right, right.
But also, it's very nice to hear what you like about the show because it's a varied show.
Yes.
We talk about different kinds of things on the podcast. It might not be so obvious from the title or the description or even a first episode summaries, the scope of what we do here on the program.
Right.
And so you can help out with that by telling folks what you like. That's nice for us to hear,
mm-hmm.
but really the value is to other listeners and potential listeners.
Yeah.
So if you can spare a minute to give us those 5 stars and write a little thing, either approach suits us just fine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whenever you got a chance. Whenever you can.
Yeah, yeah. It means a lot, especially if it comes from another listener, because we could tell people to listen to us all the time, but it's our job to do that.
Yeah.
But if a listener takes the time and lets other people know what they appreciate about the program, it means more coming from somebody outside of the clubhouse.
Yes, yes. Customer satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't prove that to anybody, but you can. You have that power.
Yeah.
Use it. All right, Lydia's back.
Hi.
Steven, tell her and me about this thing on the list here.
Right, okay. The age-old debate. Menus versus parkour. No, this is a new thing, actually. I think there was a comic on Reddit like a year ago or something mm-hmm. that was like, every game can be categorized by either being a menu game or a parkour game.
Yes.
It's a really interesting conversation because you effectively have to boil down really often complex mechanics and things about video games into these two very simple thoughts.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about that a little bit because I'm curious if there's any possible application from a dev perspective on this idea. I'm wondering if there's like potential use for specifically, I'm thinking about it in terms of like design pillars. Like
yes.
Just figuring out like literally the form your game takes determines how you should even approach making your game. So what is a menu game? What is a parkour game? A menu game, I'm defining, and obviously there's conversation about it in the various social medias.
Yeah, they're arguing the fact that there's such broad categories that aren't so... You can debate, and that's part of the fun.
Yeah, exactly. But the way what I'm describing it is games that are about like navigating menus, clicking precisely, things like that. Mm-hmm. So like Civilization, for instance, is probably... You look at that and you're like, that's a menu game.
Yeah. Board games, in a sense.
Board games. Yeah, like, yeah.
Video games that are board games when you really break them down.
Yeah, yeah. That's another avenue of looking at it. Yep. And a parkour game is a game where you do some jumps, you do physical actions, you do activities.
Must they have some jumps?
No. Ah. So like Super Mario Brothers would be a parkour game, obviously.
Right.
Many
jumps.
Yes.
But like Cooking Mama Cook-Off could also be a parkour game, yes?
Yes, it could, even though you don't do any jumping.
Right.
You do handle knives.
Cruising USA, parkour game.
Yes.
Even though you don't catch a lot of air in that game.
True. That's racing games. What is it? See, okay, so that this is part of the thing. It gets a little tricky when you start thinking about like other games and other genres. So like a racing game, I think it could go either way. I think maybe like a Gran Turismo is much more menu game than parkour game because there's a lot of actively creating your car.
There's some RPG elements
tuning
it
and
it,
such. Yeah. In a way that like Cruisin' USA, I suppose, would not.
No, that is you put a quarter in and then at the local movie theater, and then you see how much you can get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting about this, because you bring up Gran Turismo, is games that have a lot of menus don't necessarily make them menu games.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? It's I think you said this before we started, Steven, is like where the play is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So,
and of course, there are things fall on a spectrum, but it's fun to like which side of the line are they on is kind of where the fun debate is sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And so I wanted to talk about this from a game dev perspective because, like I said, I think that like there's some potential application use in defining what your game is.
Yeah.
From jump, what you were talking about here, Mark, in that like just because you're going through a bunch of menus doesn't necessarily make that game a menu game. I think is a very important aspect of it because. The play, what you're doing, what the player is excited about, the activities the player is excited about, is kind of what, in my mind, defines which kind of category this game actually is.
Yeah.
So what the example in the meme, because it's like a Calvin and Hobbes comic that this comes from, and I love Calvin and Hobbes, so that's great. The example that they bring up is Counter-Strike versus Apex Legends. Mm-hmm. They're both shooting games. You do a lot of moving your mouse and clicking at stuff. Mm-hmm. Arguably, it's a menu game because you're doing that, right?
Right. Like Martha used to say, first-person shooters are just point-and-click games.
Yeah. Exactly. But the comic argues that Counter-Strike is a menu game. Apex Legends is more parkour. And I think that is interesting because a lot of the way that Apex Legends works, I've never played Counter-Strike, but I have played Apex Legends.
Yeah.
You do a lot of movement. You do a lot of your play is based around navigating this giant map,
mm-hmm.
In ways that like give you advantages over your opponent. You do that in Counter-Strike as well, but I think a lot of what your intentions are is more about precision. I think that when people play Counter-Strike, they think of you die so quickly in Counter-Strike
you might.
Well, I haven't played it, so I'm sure I'd be amazing. No, I'm terrible at shooting games. In Counter-Strike, because you die so quickly, a lot of what you do is more tactical and strategic. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you kind of have to think a lot. I feel like a lot of the play is emphasizing the strategy.
I see what you're saying.
The thought process behind where you're going, where you're placing your teammates.
There's the hurry up and wait of it.
Yeah.
The actual fighting is kind of just... over in a flash.
Yes.
It's the it's all the work leading up to it, which is just like strategic choices. It's board gamey.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of thought people would say that's a menu game because I my understanding of Counter-Strike is that most people spend all their times in the menus to get their graphics settings to 170 frames per second. That's the only context I know that game in, so I just assumed that's what they were talking about.
Sure.
But I guess not.
I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit of an avenue in that, but that only gets you so far.
Yeah.
I think that like there's a aspect of it, it changes how it plays. And actually, listeners, let me know if I'm speaking to this poorly, because like I said, I've never played Counter-Strike. I'm terrible at shooters. I don't know what I'm talking about exactly in this respect.
I also wonder if that's an example where the idea is this joke has been around long enough that like that seems like an ironic choice.
Sure.
And maybe just me, it's a more interesting contrarian take.
Yeah.
That it really, but it's just a parkour game because it's a shooter and you got to be precise.
Mm.
You know, maybe. But I mean, there's no right answer.
Well, I mean, if you take it, I'm really bad at sarcasm, so I take it at face value.
I see.
And so I'm like, well, there must be something to this, and so that's why I was thinking about.
Yeah. Well, that I guess that's the key, right? It makes you think more about it.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what your answer is.
Right.
You start engaging with it through that lens, and that's really interesting.
And right? That's what I want to bring to it with respect to game dev is because like if you start thinking of if you think of Vengeance, for instance, as a menu versus parkour game. You know, honestly, I feel like Vengeance is probably more menus than parkour. You do a lot of thought behind the scenes trying to figure out what works best for your... Lydia, actually, let me ask you this. When you your favorite roguelike at the moment, what is your favorite roguelike? Is it probably Slay the Spire 2?
Oh, I've been mostly playing Luck Be a Landlord because my brain has been too tired, but I have been playing a lot of Slay the Spire 2.
Okay, well...
Go with either.
Okay, let's do Slay the Spire because I think that's... people might know that one more.
Yes.
How would you describe that in this debate? Is it more menus or parkour?
I think it would. Let's see. I think it would be more menus.
Sure.
Because it is in part because it's turn based.
Yeah.
I think that already lends itself to that kind of almost, as you say, board gamey strategic thought process.
Yeah.
And even when doing the two-player or the multiplayer mode, there's a you know, a give and take of like, oh, I should do this first, you should do this next.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And also because there it has that element of strategy of trying to stop and look and see kind of which way you want to go, how you want to play. There's instances of action, which then has reaction, as opposed to kind of a continuous motion. I think, like, if I had to give an example of one of my, like, comfort roguelikes where the lines would be blurred, I think it would be Peglin.
Yeah.
Because Peglin's a roguelike, but it is pachinko, where, and you can aim where your orbs go, and each orb behaves differently. So there is an element of, some of that strategery of having to figure out which way you want to go. What are you going to pick? How are you going to optimize? Or like, are you going to spend money on health or on upgrades or orbs? But then there's also on the board itself, like, okay, I have this, I'm in this situation right now. How am I going to aim the ball?
Yeah.
And seeing it react to the board as it goes down.
Yeah.
So that's one where it's like, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
But I would say Slay the Spire 2 and Slay the Spire 1, because they're very similar, is more of a menu game.
I'm starting to recognize the distinction between these two different categories. And I feel like a lot of it is what the player is actually executing and what the player is excited about executing. That changes that feel whether or not it's a menu or a parkour game.
Yeah,
like if you're excited about the planning and figuring all out, and then like you press a button and it executes, that's a menu. That's much more menu than like maybe you do a bunch of planning in the background, but the actual act of executing it and getting through that and like having to maneuver and change and adapt as things go on, that's more parkour.
There's the setup, the execution, and the payoff, and it's which part does the player engage with more in an active sense? Is it the setup or is it the execution?
Yeah.
I actually wanted to, on your list of like games that you've put down where it gets kind of dicey, I want to point out Resident Evil.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's actually, like, in my, there's actually a game someone made which is essentially just inventory management of Resident Evil. It's called Save Room.
It's
a puzzle game.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really interesting because it shows that, like, you can have playful experiences in menus.
Yeah.
That then, you know, if pulled out of the rest of its game, could be on its own, right? If it was centered in the way that the inventory management is centered in Save Room. But with Resident Evil, it is a, you know, some may see a delightful logic puzzle in the midst of getting eaten by lickers.
Yeah. I'm really, like, thinking about the games I made from a different lens now. Like, Widget Satchel. It's parkour. That's not any. It's not menus at all. Actually, now that I think about it, it's pure chaos. Yeah.
I also want to. One thing that I immediately was thinking about is if it's a menu game, what is the relationship between the player and the menu and the fiction? Mm. So I love me a interface in a game that acts like an interface. So like in Blueprints, when you log into the terminals. That always, I really like that.
I hated that so much. That's not how terminals worked.
Okay, fair. But I also really enjoy Kingsway. Sure. I love games in general where you are, you know, it's like you've logged into a computer and you're using that computer.
Sure.
Right, and that is the fiction.
Yeah.
The role play of it.
Yeah. You know. And so the UI and the experience of working with the menu. Mm-hmm. It is also more one-to-one.
Yeah.
So as opposed to like I am, it would be the difference between like I'm using a menu to put to click a troop and drag it here. It's the different, what it would actually be is like you're at a comms terminal, you click the comms, you give the order, and then you see them on your terminal reacting.
Yeah.
So I have an argument that that's a parkour game because you're taking actions, right? They're not abstracted.
Yeah, I mean...
Right? And so, and you know, you're not being judged on how fast or how well.
Yeah.
Specifically, like you would in you know, in a game with a little bit of jumping.
Yeah.
But through this lens, that kind of immersive behavior, you could say, is at least as far as it goes, more a parkour experience.
I mean, you also could be judged by your timing reaction. If this was a flight tower control simulator game.
Yeah,
If you don't move, alert the planes fast enough, they're gonna crash.
Well, I just mean independent of judging criteria.
Sure.
Fair.
You could. I mean, I think you're right. In that case, it's a little more clear cut.
Yeah.
But I think where this is a lens is leads to play style, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes people get frustrated with those immersive elements because they're not they're not the type of role player. Player,
right,
and so those feel like they're not having any fun. They're not doing anything,
yeah,
because it's neither for them parkour nor menu.
Sure,
because they're not playing anymore.
Yeah, yeah,
they're just like doing things to get through to the next sequence of that they are interested in.
Yeah,
So a lot of times I think it does have to do with play style.
Yeah,
whether you know how you experience that, and as a developer, you want to think about like guiding players that way.
Yeah,
one of the things that
right.
That I thought about with this topic came up is like, and again, I'm thinking about it a lot of times in sense of like ironic takes, because
sure.
that kind of reveals a little bit more about the depth of this conversation.
Yeah.
Which is, I think you could certainly say that like Expedition 33, famously a return to turn-based classic JRPG style game.
Yeah.
That has that game has such a focus on dodging and parrying.
Yeah.
And its overworld is very physicalized in the way that you navigate it, especially as you get Eskie later in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's an argument you could say, depending on your play style, and I say my play style because I went through all the menus about midway through the game, made the choices I liked,
yeah.
and then was able to get enough damage that I would never win into those menus ever again.
Sure.
I kept collecting new pictos, and I'm like, whatever, I'm fine with what I've got. And so I was just focusing on dodging every attack. And it's very, very, really simple mechanic with one button.
Yeah.
Because I didn't bother with parrying. But I kind of experienced that game, especially in the latter half,
yeah.
much more as a parkour game than a menu game. And that was just due to my play style.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a critique of a game like that.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like, you know, get into, you know, that game is too big in every single way.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that is too big about it is that it offers you that ability, like it's a turn-based RPG, but it just can't help itself but be an action game too in that way.
Well, I mean, I think that like I feel like you can make that argument for Super Mario RPG. I mean, it literally they have the same system.
Well, I was gonna like I was gonna preempt the argument about Paper Mario. Is that you do tend to use those, you know, A button presses every single time.
Yep.
But you master them relatively quickly.
Yeah.
and they just become a little more routine.
Yeah.
And your most of your play still is in choosing your attack,
sure.
choosing your items.
Yeah. So that would also, that similar counter argument you're making for Paper Mario would work for something like Sea of Stars, I guess.
Does it use a system similarly?
I think so.
I think a lot of turn-based RPGs have that just to keep from being super boring.
Yeah.
And there's a scale of it, and then it does come down to play style,
yeah.
right? Because I think you could easily argue with me and say, like, that's a ridiculous notion. Like, I didn't do a lot of dodging in Expedition 33, or mm-hmm. the dodging was so easy it felt like Paper Mario, so it was not parkour to me.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Sure.
And I think that's where the developer has to be careful with playtesting and
yeah.
understanding like where the play happens.
Yeah.
And if it crosses that line, making sure that it works for both types of players.
Yeah.
And that's like a double job.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Because the dichotomy is so stark.
Yeah.
And you could come up with this versus that in other ways.
Yeah.
Menus versus parkour is one fun way, but there's gotta be other this or that.
Yeah, yeah.
That could make you think about your game in the same way. To help you be more focused on what you're doing. Because in playtesting, I have seen here when we do our local playtests,
mm-hmm.
is you'll see developers try to find out what's fun about their game, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
they don't know it right away. They built a lot of things. They put it in front of players to see what works.
Yeah.
They are really happy or really proud of a certain element that maybe isn't capturing players very well.
Yeah.
And of course, in a playtest, be like, well, I just need to make that more attractive, right? I don't need to get rid of it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have multiple systems that are falling either side of that line, it could be that the enjoyment of one comes at the cost of the other.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it could be that in order to get people more excited about this one system, you actually need to lose a system that doesn't engage the sense of play that's anything like the one you really want them to engage with.
Right.
Even if both systems are really good and robust.
Yeah.
And both independently fun.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that kind of stuff is the thing that I think that really helps with this, is you're really able to narrow down what works, what you want to work,
yep.
and what is actually working. And then you can build your game towards that.
Yes.
You want your game to feel more parkour, you got to remove some of these menu elements from the game.
Right.
Yeah. If you're going to try to have it all, you need to make sure that it is really okay, genuinely, to not have to engage with the parts that you don't want to engage
right.
with.
Or the harder task is to really make sure the player does engage with both, right?
Yes.
Like, yeah.
I think it's an easier task to pick one.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to.
Yeah.
Right? There's no laws here.
Or I guess, like, not all of it. Because the example I'm thinking of specifically is Dave the Diver, where mm-hmm. it's like, I really loved, you know, diving in the ocean. I loved setting up my menu for the day, and I loved running the restaurant. I really didn't like the having to deal with the breeding of the fish, and
yeah.
the farming was like fine, but that level of menu-iness,
yeah.
that was not really what I want. I wanted to just like get fish, make sushi, and so. I did try to do, you know, for the farming, it was pretty hands-off and I needed some of those ingredients, but
sure.
for the breeding of the fish, it was like,
yeah.
whatever. But yeah. that was the thing, is I liked the fishing in the ocean so much
right.
that I didn't need to engage with that mechanic,
yeah.
that menu-y part of the mechanic at all. And that meant I could still play the game
and
do the parts that I wanted to do without being waylaid by the parts that I really didn't want to do.
What's interesting about that is I think that kind of dissatisfaction with a certain system can escape playtest feedback because you enjoyed systems that you felt were sort of compensating for.
Yeah.
And so you might, now you, because you're sort of bright and would probably understand the difference between these things. But I imagine a lot of playtesters would have a similar kind of feeling. Like, I like this part, but not that part.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily realize that they actually have a big complaint about the game.
Yeah.
They just be like, I really, really like it. Because this thing made up for the thing that didn't capture me, but then you don't really think about that at a certain point
mm-hmm.
Because you're not engaging critically enough the way that you might.
Well, and that can potentially be a strength of the game, but also that means that, like, if people are approaching it generally like Lydia is, in that, like, they like the parkour, the roguelike aspects of it more than the menuing stuff, then it's you're spending a bunch of resources building out a thing that people don't even like.
And you may have a hard time learning that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, but also then it lets you know, I think it kind of going back to, you know, what is the role of this, it does, that can give you a sense of, okay, well, what is the job that this has, that this really shines for, and if you, and is somewhat necessary or is really good to have. So, for example, if you're the type of person who in the menu-y part of Dave the Diver, you really want to max out this particular recipe and you need this particular fish for this recipe and it's hard to find or it's dangerous, then having the breeding mechanic is really, really useful. And that lets you be able to accomplish this other aspect to help supplement, like other aspect of the menu gameplay you want to engage with and you're gunning for, and supplement the parkour aspect where it's like, oh, these fish only, they're pretty rare, they're hard to get, they're dangerous to get, et cetera. And I think that's one of, I guess what I mean is, you know, yes, if you want to have it all, are they gating each other by those gameplays? Because not everyone's going to want to do everything all the time. But also, do they have an irrevocable strength and job that all else, if you need this one thing, and that's if, then this is how you do it. Same thing for the farm, where it's like, you know, a lot more of the dishes I was making involve vegetables or rice. If you want to make dishes with rice, you need to farm at least a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, but that's one, if you need it, either for the story or because you want to make those dishes. And then two, you don't have to really pay attention to it otherwise.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's that level. I think that it's one of those things where if you want to put into your energy into having all of the things, you have to understand that all of the things can't be all of the importance all of the time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of games that have like mini games, like Mario is our prime parkour example.
Right.
Like in Mario 3, you have like the memory game.
Yeah,
game or the slot machine, which is a little bit more actiony, I guess, but there are parts that you take a break from. You change context.
Yeah.
And that gives you sort of more, like you were saying, not all important all the time.
Yeah.
You can cross that line, whether it's menus versus parkour or two other opposed elements, if you basically make them modes or give them context where they're not fighting each other.
Right. Yeah.
So you can, in fact, include lots of different random stuff in your game if you like.
Mm-hmm.
If you present it in a way that like that randomization or that change of priority or play style that you impose on a player or ask a player to impose on themselves, if that is justified.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's also important for how long of a playtime total your game's going to be.
Yeah.
Because I have that feeling. One of the things I like about Persona is I can have days where it's like, I don't want to fight anything. I just am excited for the socialization and the story and the narrative and exploring.
Yeah.
And then there are other days where it's like, my brain is fried. I just want to fight things and I am going to fuse every persona that I can in the Velvet Room. And I just spend 2 hours in the Velvet Room trying to make different personas. And that is what I needed that day.
Yeah.
The fact that I can do that and because Persona is like, it's a JRPG, it's multiple hours, it's 70 something hours.
A lot of stuff.
It's a lot of stuff. I'm not going to show up to that game in the same mindset and wanting the same gameplay every single day over the course of that 70 hours because there's no possible way I could play it all in one sitting.
Right.
I mean, maybe. I'm not a speedrunner, but maybe someone's done that.
Yeah, like RPG, that's a great example, like RPG grinding versus progression.
Yeah.
Right? Progression uses the system sort of as designed. It's very menu. It's very strategic. Grinding is you managing your own time. It's much more parkour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And also, like, sometimes I'll put down an RPG and go, like, I don't feel like grinding. I'm going to wait for a day I feel like grinding.
Yeah.
Because that is the gameplay I want. And it does have that mixture. Or maybe it's, you know, more menu-y is kidding out your team. You've already ground enough, but you're trying to figure out, you know, you have all of this stuff in your inventory. You got a clean shop. Let's upgrade stuff.
Yeah.
Let's sell things.
Yeah.
Let's get all this cruft out.
Yeah. Listeners, I want to provide you with a challenge. Go to when you play test your game next and you have them fill out a sheet to give feedback. Give them a little thing. Parkour versus menus. Ask them which one it leans towards more. Explain what it is first. and ask them what it leans more towards. Maybe potentially use that feedback in your next when you're working on it next.
Yeah, pay a lot of attention to the people who say that your game is a thing that you wouldn't describe it as.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
That can help you uncover something interesting about it, or maybe discover something discongruent about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and ask why, because it may be that a longer list of features is in one, but the thing that they really liked or the thing that they spent the most time on is one feature in the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't like this idea, or you think that it doesn't work out and you tried it and it sucks, nicegames.club/feedback.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Good timing.
Yep.
We were so mean, Lydia. Oh, no. I think we brought you up once, so you're fine.
No.
That's even worse.